The Recap Show is an inside look into the world of global soccer and women's sports.
Follow and listen to The Recap Show wherever you get your podcasts.
The Dawn Show on Talk Radio 1210 WPHT and the Free Odyssey app.
As we talk about all these crazy stories of the day, somebody who is a common sense Pennsylvanian and our own Congressman Ryan McKenzie, want to get right to you. As you were you were talking about affordability long before it became, I guess, hip when a certain New York mayor was talking about it. So affordability, talking about DHS, talking about TSA workers getting paid, putting that resolution out there, and then what you're doing later today. Good morning, Congressman Ryan McKenzie.
Hey, good morning, Dawn. Always great to be back on the show.
Oh, good to have you here. Take me through what's going on with, I know that you put out a word to TSA and talking about your resolution with speaking out about, getting people getting paid and America's workers getting paid as well. So TSA, DHS funding, this is obviously the world you've been living in.
Yeah, absolutely something that needs to be addressed, and it is irresponsible of the Democrats to stand in the way of funding for ICE and CBP. We know the important work that they do to keep our country safe, and there are so many other components of Homeland Security, TSA, the Secret Service, FEMA, the list goes on and on, including our Coast Guard members. And so all of that funding is being held up by the radical left, who they cannot actually fund ICE and CBP because their base in the Democratic Party today is so radical that they know they would be primary. They'll be voted out of office on that issue alone. And so it is really jeopardizing national security by not having this funding in place. And then the workers at TSA are not getting the pay that they deserve. And that is such a detrimental thing for those workers, their families, and also our workforce. You're going to see people just leaving these positions and these jobs because they simply don't have sustainable finances. So in so many ways, such bad public policy coming out of the Democrats. But again, they are beholden to their fringe base. And so two things that I've done. First, we introduced a resolution just thanking and recognizing our DHS employees for all of their work during the shutdown when they weren't receiving pay. The Democrats were opposed to that. They fought me on the House floor even just about a resolution. Then we in the House passed a full year of funding for all components of DHS, not partial funding for different things. They rejected that. So then we said, okay, fine. How about a 2-month extension for everybody, including ICE and CBP? And we can continue to negotiate on any reforms that are being discussed or anything like that. Democrats said no again. So this is why this shutdown continues, is just this intransigence of the left. And again, very bad for our country, very bad for our national security. Now, going forward, we got to figure out a path to get around them. And so we are appealing to, there are a handful of reasonable or maybe moderate Democrat senators over in the Senate chamber. And that's what we need. We need them to get on board so that we can get the 60 votes in the Senate and finally get this passed. And then I'll close with this, Dawn, is that we need to stop this ridiculous chaos of these shutdowns. And so at the state level, when I was a state representative, what we ended up doing and transpired in state government was that workers who are in these essential positions continue to get paid while there is a budget impasse, because they're going to be showing up, they're going to be doing this job, they should be getting paid. And then once the budget gets reapproved, the funding would be there to actually accommodate that and make sure the budget is funded going forward. But this notion that people are supposed to show up for jobs for critical work and they're not going to get paid is absolutely ridiculous. And the Democrats, who say that they're the party of workers, are the ones standing in the way of these American workers doing essential jobs, and they're holding up their pay.
Yeah, and can you talk a little bit about, I just want to touch on this because I want to get to the cement workers, but you introduced the new legislation, and it's the Special Events Program Alignment Act of 2026. What does that mean, and why is it important?
we obviously have a really exciting year in our country coming up here for America's 250. Mm-hmm. We have the World Cup going on. We have all kind of special events. And this is just a common sense approach. We need to shift and realign some things in the Department of Homeland Security to make sure that these threats that are constant. I mean, we are under constant threat from our adversaries, from state sponsors of terror like Iran want to do us harm. But then there are lone wolves, individual actors who want to carry out terror acts here in the U.S. And so our homeland security is critical in preventing these things. But making sure that those events are under the proper jurisdiction within the Department of Homeland Security is important. And so we feel that a shift in that oversight is warranted at this time. It's something the department supports. We have a Democrat colleague who actually came on board to support us in introducing that legislation. So I've been trying to do some really just reasonable reforms to our department. This is another attempt in that same vein, and really just trying to make sure that we are doing everything we possibly can to keep Americans safe every single day.
And just, I saw a shout out from cement workers in Pennsylvania were thanking you for supporting them and, you know, helping with job creation. It's one of those things maybe normally I might not ask you about, Congressman McKenzie, but in this one you're talking about working people jobs, the jobs that matter to Pennsylvanians. And I saw that and I thought, you know, we don't talk enough about these jobs. These are hardworking individuals, mostly men, who are out there supporting, you know, their families, and they want to make sure they have a job. Can you speak to that and why something like that's important to you?
Sure. We have one of the largest cement producing districts in the entire country. It may even be the largest. Mm-hmm. And we have four cement plants right here in the Lehigh Valley, obviously, because of some local quarries and limestone and things like that. Geographically, that is why the concentration is here. But it is a legacy industry that has been around for a long time. My great-grandfather was the first employee at cement, a Hercules cement factory. And so he worked there his entire career. Late in life, he was still working there. But so great legacy and great jobs. And so, as you mentioned, we have hundreds of people that are employed in that industry here locally now. And what it means, though, is not only good jobs, good paying jobs that are here in our local community. Cement goes into so many different things. It's critical for construction, but it's also a critical national security component. Because if you are ever in some kind of conflict and, your adversaries want to shut off your supply chains, which we know are globalized nowadays in so many cases, we need to make sure that we have American cement. And so making sure that that industry is recognized as a critical material is very important, in my opinion. And so I introduced or sent a letter to the president asking him to introduce an executive order on that topic. And then the cement industry folks here locally were kind enough. They didn't even, let me know, or, I didn't know that thank you was coming, but they clearly appreciated the work that we're doing in Washington, D.C., in the letter that I sent. And so they sent that to the media, recognizing the work that I'm doing to help promote our local cement industry here in the Lehigh Valley.
Yeah, and this one, they said, we deeply appreciate Congressman McKenzie recently sending a letter to President Trump asking him to issue that executive order to bolster the nation's cement industry. And that's what they're mentioning, that in fact, and I think part of this was during times of the previous administration, all the regulations saying cement is bad for the environment, et cetera. And so that kills, thousands of jobs. And so they were.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, it should be noted, the last administration was so detrimental to so many parts of our economy. Any kind of heavy manufacturing, whether it was steel, cement, anything else, the layers of regulation that they were just placing on these companies, in many cases, pushed them out of business and pushed them out of the United States, taking jobs away from here, making us more dependent upon other countries. And so, thankfully, President Trump is rolling back a lot of these really onerous regulations that were placing a big burden on these businesses, and bringing back American jobs, making sure that they can grow and expand right here in our local community. So the regulatory climate is a huge positive shift. I hear about it all the time from businesses, And so, you know, thankfully the administration is carrying out that agenda to make sure that our regulations are right-sized.
You know, when you brought that up to me about the cement and that it's national security, my son Michael, whose birthday it is today, happy birthday, Michael.
Happy birthday, Penn State.
But I thought of if he were here, he would talk about how, you know, Spartacus and the Roman times and how they actually, the enslaved people during this time, actually built buildings and structures with substandard rocks, concrete, that was the Roman concrete. That's how they were able to defeat, you know, have a major defeat in a war. So, of course, I have Michael on my brain, but I thought, oh, my goodness, concrete. You think it's not a big deal. But, of course, you know, to have it like you're saying, you control the quality of it, and it does impact our infrastructure. So
that is for sure.
Let's move on to what are you doing? This is a huge event this evening that you are meeting with Kash Patel, among others. Can you describe what's going on and why it's critical?
Yeah, we have a number of elected officials coming here to join us in the Lehigh Valley today. So U.S. Senator Dave McCormick is doing an outstanding job. Dave Sunday, our state attorney general,
just
also doing a great job,
yep.
Is going to be here joining us. And then we'll be welcoming Kash Patel, the FBI director. And we are having a roundtable to talk about the continuing fentanyl crisis, how we're addressing it. And we're also meeting with families who have lost loved ones to fentanyl. And, you know, to hear their stories, see the impact, the negative impact that these drugs have on our local community, what law enforcement can be doing, and also what we should be doing as elected officials. And this does tie back into Homeland Security funding as well, in the sense that parts of ICE, you know, people want to think of ICE as only enforcement for immigration, but Homeland Security and a component of ICE is called HSI, Homeland Security Investigations. They do all kinds of things like drug trafficking, sex trafficking, gang activity, longer-term investigations and detective work that needs to be done. And without funding for that, those jobs in some instances aren't actually getting carried out. And so, again, not just leaving our community vulnerable for national security and terror threats, but also leaving our communities, our local communities, in jeopardy of not having the proper law enforcement out there on the streets doing the job, stopping the flow of drugs into our communities that has killed thousands of people here in Pennsylvania. And so it is going to be a very worthwhile, interesting discussion today. And again, looking forward to meeting with everybody as we continue our fight against drugs that kill so many people here in our local communities.
And so is this something that, how does that work? Is it the Pennsylvania GOP? Is this your office working with Senator McCormick?
So Senator McCormick had taken the lead on asking Director of the FBI, Kash Patel, to come into Pennsylvania. And Senator McCormick reached out to me two or three times. We've talked about this now in the run-up to this event and planning for it, saying, hey, I would love to do this with you, Ryan, in the Lehigh Valley. I know it's an issue. He knows it's an issue that I've talked about. He has obviously campaigned on it as well. We campaigned a lot together in 2024, and so we got to know the issues that each other cares about quite well. And so he said, this is something I know you're interested in. We'd love to be able to do this jointly in the Lehigh Valley. And so it's that kind of collaborative approach, you know, working together that actually gets results in a lot of instances. Being able to have a companion over in the Senate who can help carry legislation or initiatives in the other chamber is really important. And so grateful that Senator McCormick's a good partner in that and that he's going to be joining us here today.
Lemonade! Fresh squeeze lemonade! Lemonade? Oh, nuts.
Is your business struggling to be seen? Not reaching the right customers?
Yeah.
Odyssey's here to help. Your one-stop shop for digital marketing.
Wait, really?
With targeted digital media, plus SEO, SEM, social, OTT, and more, we help your business reach the right audience and drive results.
Whoa, hey, one at a time.
Stop missing out on valuable customers. Visit digitallocalads.com to learn more about our local advertising solutions. That's digitallocalads.com.
Okay, people, mine starts here.
Don Stensland from Talk Radio 1210 WPHT.
How important is it that you have this kind of coordination? Because I think of, you know, the Democrat Party, quite frankly, on one hand, they follow each other, but they stick together. They work together. They support each other. They campaign together and that sort of thing. And for Republicans, I always say, you know, our greatest advantages, our greatest qualities, sometimes because we're more independent and we have a larger tent of independents, Republicans, a lot of Democrat defectors, I'll say, who left the old school Democrat Party because it's gone so far left. And so why is that important to come together with all different kinds of individuals, as well as Republican leadership, as well as somebody like Kash Patel, and reach out to the community to talk about crime fighting, to talk about what's happening in our communities and connect the dots? In other words, the reason we have some of the lowest crime happening in history, and that's in Philadelphia, that's in Northampton County, it's across the nation, I believe is because of what we're seeing, a coordination federally and locally.
There's no question about it. I mean, you are correct. And so in so many of these instances, you need that coordination and collaboration from the state and local levels and federal government as well. Because if you don't, you see what happens in our local community where we have ICE going out and saying that they want to pick up individuals and local communities being obstructionists, standing in the way and saying, well, we're not going to turn them over to you directly. We're going to release them on the streets. And then ICE has to go out and pick these people up in the communities. That leaves our communities vulnerable and less safe. And so when you can collaborate and work together, we can actually get really great results. And, you know, in a separate vein, you know, I give this example. When I was in the state legislature, I was the first person that introduced legislation in Pennsylvania about deep fake images of individuals, you know, deep fake pornography, where they would use somebody's image and likeness against their will or permission. And then what do you do about that? And so ultimately, we were able to get legislation passed in Pennsylvania that criminalized that act against somebody if it was a classmate or an acquaintance or somebody who did that to you as an individual. You could press charges using the revenge porn statute. But then, you know, what happened was we also ran up against the wall. We realized, well, once these pictures go out on the internet, they're out there forever and they're spreading all across the country and all over the internet, all over the world. So it's nice that you can press charges against the person that did that, but those images might live forever. And so how do you address that? And so you actually needed federal legislation, which we had called the Take It Down Act, which now you can go to these platforms, and make them remove those images, from their websites. And so it was kind of a two-prong, a state and federal approach in that instance. And so I was grateful to be a part of that at both the state and federal level. And you needed, again, there, the House and Senate in agreement to get something like that done. So these are the relationships that matter. And if you want to actually work these issues through to completion, you need to be working together at all these levels of government.
So, Congressman McKenzie, I always have to ask you for your wife, Chloe. I know we've talked about your little ones, your son, Leo, and your daughter, Celine
we
Charlotte.
Are having a blast, Dawn. So we are in the middle of it right now. We joke sometimes. We're walking through fire here with Leo, who's almost two, and Celine, who is 3 months old now. You know, so not a lot of sleep. I come home and take the overnight shifts once I'm back from D.C. But we are just so blessed. We love every moment of it, and it's just such a fun time in our house right now.
Well, we appreciate your time. They're a little young, maybe for the next Monday, the Easter egg hunt at the Easter egg roll at the White House. So maybe in a couple years, I'm not sure.
Sounds great. And happy Easter to you and everybody else, Dawn.
Thank you. Blessed Easter. Thank you, Congressman Ryan McKenzie. Always great to talk. I know. You and Dan, you and Maisie have to, you know, when Amelia's a little older. So
yeah.
You guys are a little young. Maybe you'll be there with Congressman McKenzie and his family.
Be pretty cool to see.
A few years.
Did you and Rich go down 1 year?
I did not.
Okay.
I can't remember if Rich, I talked about it, and then I never actually did it.
Seems like an awesome event. Just so cool to see all the families out there. Yeah.
It's at least on video, it looks like a beautiful event. It'll be next Monday. And I think the weather, I was looking at the forecast as we, today, Passover beginning, obviously, this evening, and then Easter, you know, Good Friday, Easter Sunday, The weather looks like it'll hold out for the morning. And then Monday, it looks like sunny, 60s. So it should be a nice day for the Easter egg roll, the annual. All right, we'll take a quick break, right? And we have, oh my gosh, it is the craziest news day. But yes, we do have President Trump. He arrived Supreme Court as they listen to these, you know, the back and forth, the arguments being made over. And this perhaps, I'm going to say that this is of this administration, probably the most critical and a cornerstone, I'll say, piece of legislation, depending on how the Supreme Court will rule on this, which is not until June. But we'll get a good sense as we hear those arguments. So a lot riding on this for the Trump administration as they hear the birthright citizenship case with President Trump front and center. What an incredible front row seat we have to history. At Dawn Stensland, 855-839-1210. Quick break. Be right back.
I'm Jenna Fisher.
And I'm Angela Kinsey.
And together we have the podcast Office Ladies.
Just because we finished rewatching The Office does not mean we're going anywhere.
Every Wednesday, we'll be sharing even more exclusive stories from The Office and our friendship with brand new guests. Plus, you can revisit all the Office Ladies rewatch episodes every Monday with new bonus tidbits before every episode.
So follow and listen to Office Ladies on the free Odyssey app and wherever you get your podcasts.
Dawn Stensland from Talk Radio 1210 WPHT.
So some of the headlines as President Trump has a front row seat, becoming the first sitting president to attend oral arguments at the nation's highest court. So we'll get to it as those arguments are getting underway. And this has to do, of course, with President Trump's, you know, battle, if you will, his administration's battle and appeal of a lower court ruling that struck down the president's executive order, which limits birthright citizenship. Also, we know that President Trump has estimated yesterday, and we'll get to more of the audio where he was riffing, if you will, speaking live to reporters from the Oval Office as he sat at the Resolute desk. But President Trump yesterday estimating that the United States will be done in Iran in 2 to 3 weeks. But we will hear more tonight, 9 o'clock tonight. So much happening. And then President Trump signing that order directing the creation of a national voter list, which is a move that's already facing some threats of lawsuits. So we'll get to all of this, of course. And by the way, one airport was cleared to be renamed for President Trump as that's being unveiled. And another unveiling that we haven't spent a lot of time talking about, and that was the design for the new skyscraper presidential library. Eric Trump had unveiled that one in Miami. Beautiful. So we'll talk about so much and the ballroom. Oops. President Trump a little cranky yesterday when that judge's ruling came down about his beautiful ballroom. All of that, so much more breaking and developing locally, regionally, nationally, internationally, the latest on Iran. We've got it all. Stay right there.
Dawn Stensland from Talk Radio 1210 WPHT.
Tracking storms. Storms this evening, this afternoon, by 5 p.m. So we're watching those storms. How volatile will they be? Winds kicking in. But for now, we may set a record. We're 75 degrees in Philadelphia. Dawn Stensland reporting live from Odyssey World Headquarters right here in beautiful Philadelphia. The Supreme Court hearing these arguments in this birthright citizenship case. This is a critical case. And as you well know, important to President Trump. And I will say a cornerstone of some of his policies. Remember, he signed this executive order on day one when he was sworn in on January 20th. We all remember that one. And so now it goes to the high court after a lower court kicked it back and said, no, you can't do that, questioning this within saying it's protected within the 14th Amendment. How many births are we talking about that would not be considered legal? Would be about two. I'm looking at all of the different estimations. It looks like everybody agrees on about 255,000 babies born every year in this country to mothers who are here illegally. And so right now you're looking at about 255,000 babies who are automatically given birthright citizenship. But under this, if the Supreme Court goes with Trump and sides with Trump, then, of course, that means those 255,000 babies would not be considered American citizens. This would be a huge change. So what we're hearing, and Dan Borowski, executive producer, monitoring all of this. And so I've been seeing that we have Amy Coney Barrett, Justice Barrett, as well as, of course, who is it? Justice Kennedy. It looks like he's pushing back on this. So let's listen in.
Yeah, and here's John Roberts pushing back.
Oh, excuse me.
Having said all that, you do agree that has no impact on the legal analysis before us?
I think it's, I quote what Justice Scalia said in his Hamdan dissent, where their interpretation has these implications that could not possibly have been approved by the 19th century framers of this amendment. I think that shows that they've made a mess, their interpretation has made a mess of the provision.
Well, it certainly wasn't a problem in the 19th century.
No, but of course, we're in a new world now, as Justice Alito pointed out, to where 8 billion people are one plane ride away from having a child who's a U.S. citizen.
Well, it's a new world. It's the same Constitution.
It is, and as Justice Scalia said, I think in the case that Justice Alito was referring to, you've got a constitutional provision that addresses certain evils, and it should be extended to reasonably comparable evils. He said that about statutory interpretation. I think the same principle applies here, and I think we quote that in our brief.
Thank you. Justice Thomas?
So one thing I'll say with, I know that, arguing on the Trump administration side is John Sauer, and he does have that raspy voice, but you can hear him chewing on a cough drop or whatever. So he does have a raspy voice, but he's gone full on RF, not to be mean or anything, but not for nothing. You're going before the Supreme Court of the United States of America in a critical case, making history, and you're going all full on RFK Jr. Am I wrong here? Does his voice sound more raspy as God's punishing me because my voice gets raspy when I say that? I'm just saying. It's a critical point, but you hear Chief Justice John Roberts pushing back. And so social media now is erupting with Roberts is pushing back. He doesn't like this. He's going to vote against this. And so do you have any with, I'm looking up now. Look who it is now. I mean, we could do this all day, but we just had Coney.
Seeking to have this turn on domicile.
Anji.
I think you have a number of hurdles to accomplish those two things. One of which I think is that when we look at this court's case law, and no one I think has mentioned Schooner's Exchange, but it appears that was an 1812 case in which it seems as though the court had already accepted at the time of the ratification of the 14th Amendment that the allegiance that you're talking about was the English common law rule. That, in other words, allegiance meant that you are covered by the laws of the jurisdiction, that you can rely on that jurisdiction's protection. That's what allegiance meant. Now, you're saying today, no, allegiance meant something about loyalty or that kind of idea. But if the Supreme Court had, prior to the 14th Amendment, established that allegiance meant the common law definition, I think your first hurdle is to help us understand why we would believe that when the 14th Amendment was ratified, the framers weren't just incorporating what we had previously said it meant.
Page 572 of the Congressional Record directly addresses this. They say the concept of temporary and local allegiance from the Schooner Exchange is what is meant by, or temporary and local jurisdiction from the Schooner Exchange is what is meant by the word jurisdiction in the 14th Amendment. Senator Trumbull says, I thought about saying owing allegiance, but again, quote, there's a sort of allegiance from persons temporarily resident in the United States whom we have no right to make citizens. So he expressly and consciously rejected reliance on Schooner.
What do we do with, I mean, that's a debate, and it's a discussion, very valid, but then we have a subsequent debate between Fessenden and Wade, where the same concept comes up, and it becomes clear, at least from Senator Wade's perspective, that that's wrong. So Fessenden, and I'm not sure whether these are senators, I apologize, Fessenden says, suppose a person is born here of parents from abroad temporarily in this country. Wade responds, the senator says a person may be born here and not be a citizen. I know that is so in one instance, in the case of the children of foreign ministers who reside near the United States, et cetera, et cetera. So it appears as though in that exchange, at least Senator Wade believed that the English common law understanding of what it means to have allegiance, to be a temporary person on the soil, was what was being adopted.
Yeah, that exchange strongly supports us. If you look at it in context, Senator Wade has introduced a version that says only birth on U.S. soil and doesn't have any allegiance or jurisdictional element to it. And so Senator Fessenden stands up and says, well, that can't be right because, you know, obviously, what about the children of temporary visitors? It has this, you know, it's another one of these statements that has this appeal to a background understanding that we all agree that the temporary visitors, their children, do not become citizens. And then Senator Wade has to kind of backtrack and say, well, what are the children of ambassadors? And in the end, Congress does not adopt Senator Wade's proposal. So we think that to the extent you can draw an inference from that, the inference strongly supports
it. All right. Well, let me just ask you about why we wouldn't see.
So here we are, the birthright brawl, as we hear Supreme Court justices expressing some skepticism that's going on during these oral arguments over President Trump's executive order that is trying to end the auto birthright citizenship. Well, she's not a Supreme Court justice.
Dawn Stensland from Talk Radio 1210 WPHT.
Our Linda Kearns, well, I'll say is the goddess of all. No, well, goddess, the queen, the, hey, Linda, how are you?
Good morning. Good morning, John. How are you doing?
I love the
This is quite the news week, huh?
Today, I'm telling you, since about 5:59 when we came on, story after, it's just kook. It's crazy. Is it a full moon? I think it's a full moon. It was a very...
Is it a full moon?
I think it tonight? Must be, you guys. It's just a weird, wacky news day. All day. Not so, but...
April 1st.
Oh, see?
Full moon.
I felt it.
Wow.
I felt the full moon vibe.
Before you go forward, can I just make note, Linda's face, she loves law. She was following along with the Supreme Court. She is, I could see like her eyes were moving back and forth, and she was like almost like watching ping pong. It was yeah. You're really into this stuff, huh, Linda?
Not Forrest Gump ping pong. We're just going. So I want to get your take, Linda Kearns, as you listen, especially to the Chief Justice, John Roberts, your take as you hear his skepticism and pushing back.
Well, Dawn, I think in listening to these arguments go back and forth, one of my big complaints about all these cases that get to the Supreme Court is I would like to hear these arguments on the floor of the legislature, not in front of nine appointed justices. And a lot of what they're arguing back and forth is something that we should, our elected representatives should be arguing. However, it is cumbersome to amend the Constitution. It takes a lot. It's sometimes a little bit easier to issue an executive order and then let this flow up through to the Supreme Court. And what they said earlier, he said that we now have 8 billion people who are only a plane ride away who could come here and give birth. And then Justice Roberts said, yeah, but we still have the same Constitution. Our framers designed our Constitution to change it and to have this amendment process. And I don't think anyone ever envisioned that a president would change it by executive order. And I understand what President Trump was trying to do. I mean, I think with what things he does is to bring the issue to the forefront, like almost playing chess, because, you know, it had to be expected that this would be challenged and a difficult thing to pass, you know, constitutional scrutiny. So I'm hoping that these things get more forced on the legislature. But of course, you know, getting something through Congress takes a really long time, but that's really where these arguments are. And then I also look at it from an administrative viewpoint, Dawn. I was looking at my birth certificate the other day. I was born in Pennsylvania. It's yellow and it has a little bit of a raised seal. But because it says that I was born here in Pennsylvania, then we all know I'm a citizen. So I'm not even sure how they would. Let's just say that this birthright that we're going to say that if you're here and your parents aren't citizens, you're not going to be a citizen. Well, we're going to put the burden on hospitals. Like, I'm wondering, too, how this is going to get administered, which, again, why some of these things belong in the legislature, because, you know, that type of thing can be all sorted out better than at the Supreme Court. So those are my preliminary thoughts on all this. But it's fascinating to hear the arguments.
Well, so. Perhaps what it would be is that you're born in the hospital and then something's submitted. But the hospital does not give the parents the birth certificate. Right. It's mailed to you. So in that case,
you fill out the paperwork.
You fill out the paperwork at the hospital, but then it's sent in.
It's sent in. The state gives
it. And then the state would distribute it. So at that point, would the state need proof of citizenship by the mother at that point to receive?
What if your dad is a citizen and your mom's not?
See, that's a great question.
What if I'm born and my mom never names my dad, and so I'm not a citizen because my mom was not a citizen, and then 5 years later I find my dad, or 10 years later, and he's a citizen. Do I then become a citizen? I mean, these are the things like I think about when I'm watching these arguments. Like, it's not just okay, magic wand. If your parents are citizens, you'll be a citizen. Administering this kind of stuff is really cumbersome and unwieldy. So I that's probably why I'm looking at it in fascination. Like, my mind is really turning.
And I know that we saw Justice Coney Barrett speaking in a moment ago. So hopefully we can get Amy, what you going to do? I want to see what she's doing. But I will just ask you this, as far as this goes, is there a chance that the court agrees with the first thing you said, Linda? And that is, This should be before Congress. This is something that needs to be debated within Congress, and you should not have a high court legislating.
Maybe.
Because we're seeing that too. Is that possible?
Sure, sure. And that, you know, remember, the Supreme Court decides what cases to take. They don't take every case. So they felt that this was ripe for them to take, and that might be how they settle it, that they're going to say this is not something that we're going to address, that this is not what the Constitution as written allows. So basically, then the message is, if you want to change it, amend the Constitution and then pass some laws as to how you're going to make this happen. But President Trump, with these executive orders, and, you know, they're certainly free flowing out of that White House.
Right.
He's definitely bringing all these conversations and so forth to the forefront.
And there he is, knowing that he's making history, and how much of an impact, this is what I'm going to ask Linda to answer on the other side, how much of an impact does it have in the court physically that President Trump is right there front and center as these arguments are being made? Here is Justice Barrett, Coney Barrett.
Justice Barrett.
So, General Sarah, I want to zoom out a little bit and think about jus soli and jus sanguinis. So as I understand it, at the time of the 14th Amendment, those were the two dominant approaches. You know, jus soli, the English common law, roughly following the soil. Jus sanguinis, roughly citizenship following the parents. Now, jus soli was very generous on the soil, the English common law, and so it extended citizenship to those born there who may not have been born of parent citizens. But jus sanguinis, you know, if parents who were citizens and had a child abroad, then that child's citizenship followed the parents. So one thing that's puzzling me about your argument, when I think about the ratification of the 14th Amendment, in many ways it would have made sense for them, and you acknowledge the jus sanguinis in citing Vattel, it would have made sense in some ways for them to say, okay, we're going to follow, if they wanted to accomplish what you're saying they wanted to accomplish, you could say, well, we're going to follow jus sanguinis because we're going to make it all ride on parentage. But instead, I mean, the 14th Amendment, we're talking about subject to the jurisdiction thereof, but it also says born in the United States. So you have the jus soli kind of point there, but you're saying it narrowed that point by tying it to the citizenship of the parents, at least as the soil. But I take it you're not arguing that United States citizens who have children born abroad would qualify for birthright citizenship. So it's kind of a narrower view of both the traditional jus soli rule and a narrower view of the jus sanguinis rule. So why would they have done that? And if they were going to invent an entirely new kind of citizenship, like an American brand, why wouldn't we have seen more discussion of that in the debates?
I think you do. And I think the right way to conceptualize it, it is much more, it is a modified jus soli. Because even the British sources don't just say, you're born here, you're a citizen. They say, you're born here, and you have to be under the protection of the sovereign. You have to have a relationship of allegiance. Allegiance is the word in Calvin's case.
But they don't focus on the parents. It's the child. And your approach focuses on the parents' allegiance.
Yeah, I'm not sure that that's true of the 19th century
sources. It seems a little
ambiguous,
and I'm going to ask your friend on the other side that question.
Let me point out, then, that there are two criteria. One is birth on the soil, and the other is allegiance or allegiance. What we have is birth on the soil remains the same, right? And so they are, and that's why so much of Wong Kim Ark is actually we agree with, because they are adopting a modified British rule. They are not going the French rule, you know, that Vattel talks about, where it's like, who's the citizen? That had to be done by statute, as you pointed out, which it was in 1401. But what they've got is they say birth in the United States and subject to the jurisdiction thereof. That is talked about as allegiance, allegiance, allegiance in the congressional debates. But they were clearly not incorporating the British feudal monarchical conception of allegiance, where it's indefeasible. I mean, going back to the early 1700s, our nation had repudiated the notion that citizenship is indefeasible. The expatriation statutes from the late 1700s reflect that. And again, you look at the 1868 congressional report that we cite there, this is the same group of congressmen, Republican congressmen, and they say things like, the U.S. Constitution itself is proof that Blackstone's theory of allegiance was not accepted. So they accept birth on U.S. soil, but then they take the concept of allegiance and give it its Republican, Democratic, American understanding. And that's very, very, I think that makes a ton of sense.
So, okay, let's just move into this. You can hear the skepticism. Here's another justice who's maybe on the conservative side of things, Linda Kearns, you know, and I know people want, you know, I know some of you on the YouTube chat want to talk about who does it. Look, the bottom line is the United States and Canada are the only developed countries with this kind of policy. That's pretty much across the board. So let's stick to this. With the United States of America, this is a critical change if this went through. I hear a lot of skepticism as they go through the history and try to define, you know, all of this, the jus soli. What do you see? What do you hear, Linda?
Well, Dawn, you know, Justice Scalia once said that, and I'm paraphrasing, something along the lines of, you're not really being a good judge if you like every conclusion that you come to. And even though we may say, hey, it's not fair that you can just come here, have a baby and have that baby be a citizen and that's being abused. Even if we think that that's not a good policy, that's a completely separate issue than looking at the Constitution and saying this is what we're allowed to do by executive order or not allowed to do by executive order. So it's really two completely separate questions. So just because, you know, if this ruling comes out in a way that, you know, maybe preserves what we have now, which is you're born here and you're a citizen, that doesn't necessarily mean that's how the justices personally think this law should be. It just means that they're interpreting the Constitution. And I think that sometimes gets lost in some of the debate over this and when it's discussed in popular media.
Yeah, I hear you. We're way overdue for a break. Can you stay a little bit, Linda
Absolutely.
Kearns?
Absolutely. I love my Wednesdays with Dawn and Dan.
We love Linda, who loves the law. So we'll continue after this. Got to talk about spring has sprung just in time for the Acura Spring into Performance event going on right now, Piazza Acura. You can lease a new 2026 ADX SUV. Or what about the sporty Integra? That starts at just $239 a month for 36 months. So if you're looking to purchase, Piazza has you covered with financing as low as 1.99%, 60 months. Find the unforgettable driving experience that you've been waiting for at Piazza Acura of Ardmore, Reading, Westchester. See your local Piazza Acura dealer for offer details. PIAZZA, Piazza Acura, PiazzaHonda.com, PiazzaAcura.com, I should say, PiazzaAutoGroup.com, Piazza, PIAZZA. Tell them Dawn sent you.
Dawn Stensland from Talk Radio 1210 WPHT.
History in the making, the Supreme Court of the United States, President Trump, with a front row seat as the attorneys and the justices go back and forth. So in this one, Dan, we're here with Linda Kearns, executive producer Dan Borowski's here. Dan, so you have, and we'll just do one more point on this if we can, because Linda, you personally were involved in a case that you sent us last night talking about this. Someone, as far as a Philadelphia man, a local case, making threats to kill an election official. We have a big update on that. So I want to get to that. That's my tease. But let's tee this audio up, and this is more at the Supreme Court.
Yeah, it's John Sauer. He's talking now about allegiance to the nations and such, and how that has changed over the years when talking about birthright citizenship. He's pressed by John Roberts. Two voices you hear is the scratchy one of John Sauer and the other voice of John Roberts. Take a listen.
Well, starting with that theory, you obviously put a lot of weight on subject to the jurisdiction thereof. But the examples you give to support that strike me as very quirky. You know, children of ambassadors, children of enemies during a hostile invasion, children on warships. And then you expand it to a whole class of illegal aliens are here in the country. I'm not quite sure how you can get to that big group from such tiny and sort of idiosyncratic examples.
There are those sort of narrow exceptions for ambassador foreign public ships. Tribal Indians is an enormous one that they were very focused on in the debates as well. But what I do is I invite the court to look at the intervening step, which is the enactment of the Civil Rights Act of 1866. And there they didn't say subject to the jurisdiction thereof. There it says not subject to any foreign power. Now, if you go back to Blackstone and Calvin's case, they say it does not matter if you are subject to any foreign power. If you are born in the king's domains, you have this indefeasible duty of allegiance to the king at any time. So there's a clear repudiation in the Civil Rights Act. The Civil Rights Act is this breakwater which makes it very, very clear that they are not thinking about allegiance in the terms of like the British common law. They've adopted the Republican conception of allegiance. So it's from not subject to any foreign power, and then the debates just a couple months later make it very clear that they're recodifying the same conception. They were dissatisfied with the potential ambiguity in the phrase Indians not taxed, and they adopted subject to the jurisdiction thereof. And one of the strongest statements of this is Senator Trumbull's statement that I quoted at the beginning, where he's asked, what does that mean, subject to the jurisdiction thereof? And he says, it means not owing allegiance to anybody else. That is what it means. And this court picked up on that in Elk against Wilkins when it says, it uses, you know, completely subject to the political jurisdiction, not merely regulatory jurisdiction.
So, Linda, what do you take as far as the allegiance issue? I think people interpret and misinterpret this part, but the word allegiance and the use of this clause is critical to this debate, right?
Yeah, and what they're going back and forth and doing is, remember, these words in the 14th Amendment, they were written a very, very long time ago. And what they're trying to determine is, what did those words mean at the time? And that's kind of the debate that's going back and forth. Not necessarily what they think that the people were thinking when they wrote this, but more with these words as written and English use of that time, what did these mean as written down? And that's kind of the debate that's going back and forth now, and that's going to drive their decision.
Yeah. So not foreign powers. So I do think the timeline, and I love hearing this stuff, and I know you do too, but we want to move on to the next case. But I think the fact of when this was written, right, the context within which it's being written is clearly when they're trying to give the former slaves now citizenship rights.
Right.
And so, you know, I'm going to say this, and maybe I shouldn't say this, but John Sauer, I mean, I know he knows his stuff, but the voice, the RFK.
I know. Does he always sound like that?
I don't think it's usually this bad. I know he has a raspy voice, but you could hear him. He was like chewing on a peppermint or whatever. Yeah. But man, that's.
And remember, these are the oral arguments. So this is just it's a very brief period where they get up and they talk and the justice can ask questions. But there are briefs filed, responsive briefs, reply briefs, and then friend of the court brief. So there's all sorts of written material that these justices are looking at. And, you know, I think that the justices might even going into this have already kind of thought where they're leaning, but then they're going to ask questions to kind of tease out some arguments. But because that this is, you know, well, they don't televise the inside of the room, but they're obviously televising outside the building, and because mm-hmm. President Trump was there, everyone's focused on the oral argument part. But you know, the real work is done by reviewing all the briefs.
Ah. So I want to move on. Speaking of which, when you talk about the real work, this is something that I know you were very involved with and very concerned about. And the headline is that a Philadelphia man has been sentenced to 10 months in prison for threatening to kill an election official. So kudos to you and you know, those who you've been working with, Linda Kearns, to bring this to justice. This was a horrible case that we've been talking about.
Right. This was during the 2024 election, and our election workers, whether they worked for the RNC or directly for the campaign or for one of the candidates or for a committee, a lot of times they would give their personal cell phone out. And this woman up in the northwestern part of the state, Erie, one of our workers, she had given out her phone number, and then she got these horrible messages that said, "I will kill you if you don't answer me. Your days are numbered," and then a foul word. "You're gonna effing find you. I'm gonna effing find you and skin you alive and use your skin for effing toilet paper." So this came across
like Hannibal Lecter kind of stuff too.
This came across her personal cell phone, and you know, she contacted her boss, and then they contacted me, who because I was counsel to the campaign here in Pennsylvania. And we were able to figure out pretty quickly the number came from Pennsylvania, because, you know, you can Google look up or, you know, reverse look up that it not only came from inside Pennsylvania, it looks like somebody from Philadelphia. The problem, though, Dawn, was jurisdiction. It's a federal campaign. So who do you report this to? The victim was up in Erie, Pennsylvania. The perpetrator, we thought, was in Pennsylvania, was in Philadelphia. So who's responsible? Do the Erie people come down and investigate? Do the Philadelphia people investigate? So that took a lot of legwork on my part to really just chase it down. And I did get some resistance at first, like Philadelphia police said, "Well, the victim's not here," and so. But by really just keeping up with it, and then I contacted the Department of Justice and the FBI, and I explained to them that this was a federal election and this is very serious. We finally did get cooperation, which was great, and they indicted this man, and he was sentenced to 10 months in prison. And I hope that this gets a little more play out there, because we need to take these things way more seriously. It's fine to debate ideas. It's not fine to attack people like this. And getting those types of messages on your phone, that's very, very scary. You know, you don't know if the person's going to follow through. I have that other case, the Public Interest Legal Foundation, all the people who got the letters through the U.S. Yes. mail. And you can't really change people. But if they see that, look, if you get caught, there's serious consequences. And this guy is now going to, you know, he's sentenced to 10 months in prison. That's no small thing to go to federal prison for 10 months. So I applaud the Department of Justice that really, you know, went after this, and also the victim, because she had to continue to cooperate and testify. So maybe this will deter somebody for the next time around. That's what I'm hoping, Dawn.
So in this case, it's 63-year-old John Courtney Pollard of Philadelphia, sentenced to 10 months in prison. So it's a federal case. Notice that. This is not D.A. Krasner or something of that nature, by the way. 10 months in prison, $5,000 fine, spending a year on probation following his release after serving that 10 months, after he sent a regional election integrity director threatening messages, and that was back in September of 2026. Yeah, I mean,
24.
Oh, excuse me.
Yeah.
Oh, you know what? There's a misprint, actually.
Okay. Yeah.
One of the news releases, but that's okay. Yeah, thank you. Obviously, before the election.
Right.
Of 24. So, "I will kill you if you don't answer me. Your days are numbered," calling her the B word. As a female, calling her the B word for a female dog, "Gonna effing find you and skin you alive. Use your skin, as you said, for effing toilet paper." You bleep bleep, calling her effing horrible expletives, calling her names, threatening her. And I would say, I don't know, what is that, like a gender slur? I'm trying to think of what that would be called, but the B word. In this one, he was, you know, this woman must have been terrified.
Because I spoke with her very soon after getting it. And remember, at the time, President Trump had been shot in July. So think of the time frame that we were dealing with.
Oh, and good point.
Just, emotions were just so high. And as a campaign worker, you are putting yourself out there. You're knocking on doors. You're holding these in-person seminars and in-person trainings and you know, in-person rallies and so forth. So you're really putting yourself out there. And to think that someone's going to physically hurt you, what, because they don't like, you know, who she was working for? And, you know, really, really chasing this down and making sure it gets prosecuted is just one of the only tools we have to stop it on the next go round. So I would hope that, I don't know if this made the Philadelphia Inquirer, but it needs to get around that there's serious consequences to this type of behavior.
And kudos to U.S. Attorney for the Western District, who you mentioned, of Pennsylvania, Troy Rivetti, releasing that and saying that they're all committed to protecting free and fair elections, election integrity. The one thing I don't see, even though I see a sprinkling of stories, and like you're saying, it's being buried, but I don't even see a victim impact statement. So how does this work? Did he plead guilty? How is he?
Oh, so in the press release from the Department of Justice, they actually quoted from her statement, and she did just a really,
so nobody's
really good
quoting
job.
That I'm seeing.
Yeah, she
in the
said
coverage.
In her statement that the threatening text began a year-long ordeal filled with fear and constant vigilance. And she urged the court to send a strong message to the country that there is zero tolerance for making death threats against anyone, especially those serving in political or civic roles. Many of us are simply fulfilling our civic duty, yet we are becoming targets of a kind of hatred that is difficult to describe. And you have to remember who's in some of these roles.
Yeah.
These people don't have, you know, money.
Security.
To have security. You know, not everyone lives in a house, you know, maybe behind a gate or with a with a front desk or something. So you're really just out there. You're exposed. And it's just getting too easy to just use text or social media and to just threaten people. And it's just not okay. Absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, if I were the U.S. Attorney for the Western District, Troy Rivetti, I would have Linda there at the court or available, because I think you need, first of all, and we love Linda, but you need a female voice to say this, to speak on behalf of the victim here, to even read her statement or say this woman was terrified, to make sure that people understand that this is not just some perfunctory, oh, it's an election thing. And you know what I mean? That this was a threat to a real person who was trying to do the right thing and be involved with trying to make sure that our elections are full of integrity.
Right. But with the news cycle like it is, and there's just so many things in the news, and something more salacious happens, and then you kind of forget about this. So,
well, what's salacious in the world has happened, Linda? What do you... Dan, do you know what she's thinking of?
No, not at all.
What, salacious?
No.
Dawn.
No.
I can't think of a thing.
I wonder about, a lot of the senior citizens are thinking about this, because they're looking at this, at these stories and thinking, what is the world coming to? Because I know I was speaking to my mom about it this morning, and she just couldn't even put it into
words.
Are
we talking about the same thing?
Yes, I think we're...
Do you want me to put it up there for you?
Do you want to put it up there? Jeez. Yeah. Here, let's see. If you're on the YouTube chat, we appreciate you. Look at this. I don't know. I was picking up, because my wash machine broke yesterday, and I was at the laundromat, and then I'm picking up a little salad for my husband, and then I got this.
Dan, and seriously.
I'm sorry. We have to have fun with this, you guys. If you think it's inappropriate, I don't care, quite frankly.
I think that's hysterical.
I'm sorry, but I texted this to my husband, Larry, and I go, Larry Bear, I'm bringing you a Cobb salad, and honey, I'm glad that the only boobs you like are mine. I'm just saying. I mean, this is a husband. I'm sorry, but come on.
You know what I was thinking, Dawn?
Yeah.
These people get vetted when you get appointed to these positions, and she had a security clearance. I'm wondering why they didn't find this out in the vetting.
Hmm.
Like, why did... They're supposed to be really looking into these people. Why did they not discover this?
They're looking in all the wrong... They're not looking at little fetish online. So Linda and I are like-minded and have one question that I realized in the commercial break we chatted. So on the other side, I want to hear what Linda, one of the first reactions, well, maybe the second or third, and this is Kristi Noem's husband, Brian. I mean, they've been together more than 3 decades. They met when they were teenagers. They have 3 now adult children. But I want you to hear what Linda's take, and I love that you and I think alike on this, and maybe you have a take. So we'll take a quick break and get to this. This is Mr. Noem. And what he dresses up as.
Oh, why do his nipples look like Marty Feldman's eyes?
Because, I don't know.
I think that's a prosthetic thing, though, isn't it?
They said that it's balloons.
No, it's not balloons.
It's not.
Look at the nipples.
I thought I read that it was the balloons, and that's where you tie the balloon.
No.
That makes the nipple.
Mm-mm. No.
That's Marty Feldman that I'm putting up there on the board.
But, oh, my gosh.
Oh, my heavens.
Guys.
Yeah, it's...
I wonder if this guy, Mr. Noem, is even more titillated by the fact that now his picture is just all over the world at this point. I wonder if this is making him even more excited.
What do you think?
I don't know.
855-839-1210. We will be right back.
Dawn Stensland from Talk Radio 1210 WPHT.
Yeah, so one of the many breaking news, there's so many breaking news stories, but I will just tell you that some of the headlines here are that with regard to the FBI, a headline here as ex-FBI agents on those Trump cases, remember Mar-a-Lago, etc., those ex-agents are suing and naming FBI Director Kash Patel as well as Attorney General Pam Bondi, claiming that they were illegally fired in a so-called retribution campaign. So just one of the headlines, 3 former FBI agents who worked these criminal cases at the time against President Trump, and then they were booted by the administration. They filed a lawsuit. I'm not surprised. Are you, Linda Kearns?
No. And I mean, God bless the people in this administration. Just, I don't know how they're getting any sleep. I mean, it's just constant lawsuits and crises. And I'm wondering if they're looking forward to when all this is over. Must be exhausted.
That's just it. These jobs are high stress, high performance jobs to begin with. But then to work for Trump in the Trump administration, which Trump derangement syndrome, whatever you want to call it, adds another layer.
Right.
Because you're constantly under attack.
Yeah, it's constant.
It's crazy. It's like, it's not a thick skin, it's bulletproof skin. And figuratively, I hate to say it, but on many levels. All right. So as far as Kristi Noem's husband, Brian Noem, if you haven't heard, where have you been? But this went viral as somebody leaked to, or the Daily Mail claims they found it. They didn't find it. It was somebody sent them these photos of Brian Noem, who is Kristi Noem's longtime husband, more than 30 years. They met as teenagers. She was 20 when they were married. They have 3 children. And here it is. Here's the picture.
Dawn, I said to you, and you might have mentioned this. Look, I'm not surprised by any of this because, remember, I'm an attorney and I do a lot of family law. So
you see stuff like this?
Yes.
You do?
Yes. I've seen stuff that would make your hair curl. And so I'm not necessarily surprised by what goes on behind closed doors.
So as a family attorney, you know, married people sometimes have freaky secrets in their closet.
Yes, okay. Absolutely. And I've seen the pictures and the videos and the, you know, and it's just basically when you do it for this long, you just kind of, all right, it's just part of the job. But
the videos.
What I don't understand is
we'll
have to do a whole show on that. Maybe that's a podcast episode.
Woo!
What I don't understand, though, is if you're going to be out there on the internet, why didn't he disguise himself? He could have worn a wig, glasses, something, and it wouldn't have been so obvious that it was him. I know ever since I got involved with Trump in 2016, I've been very careful. I don't post personal things on social media, and I'm just very careful about anything personal because I just feel like I don't want there to be an article about me and then referencing, you know, personal things about me. And I remember this news reporter was doing some expose on me. I think this was in 2020. And he contacted one of my friends, Joe DeFelice, whose aunt listens to your program. So if you're listening, Joe's aunt. And I remember the reporter expressed frustration to Joe and said, I can't find anything on Linda to write about her. And Joe said, yep, that's how she designs her whole life. So if I'm doing that and I'm just like a mere celebrity here in Philly, why did Noam's husband not think like, hey, maybe I should just be if I'm going to do this, like maybe I shouldn't be so obvious that it's me. And I had even read that a part of this is not just the photos. It's like they have texting or going back and forth. And he was actually talking about his wife. Like what was he thinking? Did he want to be caught? Is that part of it?
And that he sent, so these little fetish pages that exist involve money. That he allegedly was living this double life, sending tens of thousands of dollars, allegedly.
I can't even imagine. I mean, everyone needs a hobby.
A hobby. Well, Ms. Noam is devastated. That's her statement. Please pray for us. Yeah. I don't even know how that prayer goes.
What prayer is it?
I don't know if God wants it. Like, you know what I mean? Like, he's like, I know. I don't know I guess for their children and, you know,
I feel
very
bad
public.
For their children. Even if the wife did know about this, the children probably didn't. And jeez. I can't imagine what they're going through right now and the grandchildren. And
if they get together for Easter, that Easter egg hunt is a little awkward.
Can you imagine Easter dinner at their house?
Nope.
Dawn, are you cooking Easter dinner?
Nope.
Oh, no?
Nope.
Oh.
We go to, full disclosure, we go to Mike's Seafood because Mike and Jeannie Monachetti down the shore, Seattle City.
Gotcha. Okay.
So Mike and Jeannie do everything. We just show up, bring wine. It's wonderful.
Sounds like a great day.
Happy Easter, my friend.
And I hope the Easter Bunny is good to everybody.
Aw. Happy Easter. And yes, first day of Passover this evening. We may set a record temperature-wise as we look at possibly exceeding 81 degrees. Dom Giordano is up next.
The Dawn Show on Talk Radio 1210 WPHT and the free Odyssey app.
The podcast Campus Files is back with more stories of scandal, crime, and intrigue on college campuses. Campus Files, available now wherever you get your podcasts.